Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Low-wage workers across the country are taking to the streets to demand better working conditions and a living wage. Last Thursday, fast food workers in over 100 cities went on strike to call for their wages to be increased to $15 an hour. Workers in the fast food industry, which employs more than 4 million Americans, earned an average of $8.72 an hour in 2010. Their ultimate goal is to get a collective bargaining agreement. And then on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, Walmart workers went on strike and held rallies in front of almost 1,500 stores, demanding fair wages and predictable schedules. Over 825,000 Walmart workers make less than $25,000 a year. Those who want full-time work say they can't get it and rarely know what their schedules will be like from week to week. Walmart workers are asking for an end to retaliation for speaking out, full-time work for those who want it, and $25,000 a year. Non-unionized retail and fast food service sector jobs have seen growth as private sector jobs decline, leaving older and highly educated workers with nowhere else to go for work. But earning only minimum wage or a little bit above it leaves them unable to pay for essentials like food and transportation, and many have no choice but to rely on public assistance to make ends meet. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about this growing movement. What are workers facing as they battle for a living wage and full-time work? And how much power do low-wage workers have to change the workplace? Today, we're joined by Arun Gupta, founding editor of The Independent magazine and co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. He's a contributor to In These Times. He has a piece out called Fight for 15 Confidential. How did the biggest ever mobilization of fast food workers come about and what is its end game? He's also working on a book about the decline of the American empire. Hi, Arun. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you today.
Great to have you. We're also joined by John Schmidt, senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He focuses on a number of issues, including minimum wage, unions, and employment. He recently co-edited Low Wage Work in the Wealthy World. And John joins us from Washington. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks.
Nice to have you. So, John, let's start off with you. First of all, can you talk about the changing face of the low-wage worker sector? It's definitely not what it was, say, 20, 30 years ago. Talk about the changes that we've seen.
I think it is striking how much a view of the low-wage labor market we have seems to be kind of left over from the 1950s or 1960s. If you look at workers who made, say, less than, say, about $10 per hour back at the end of the 1970s, that workforce is a lot different than the workforce that makes less than $10 an hour today. The workforce today is much better educated. People are much less likely to have only a high school degree or less than a high school degree. There are a lot more college-educated workers, a lot more workers that have some college but might not have finished. The other thing is the workforce is a lot older than it used to be. Back in the 1970s, a decent share, maybe a fourth or more, of low-wage workers were teenagers. Now it's only about 1 in 8, and we have a lot of adults who are making very low wages relative to our historical experience.
Well, so, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no. So I think there is we have an older and a much better educated low-wage workforce. We used to pay people with these skills a lot more money 35 or 40 years ago than we pay them today.
So they actually made more money in the 70s than they're making now.
Yes. The minimum wage, if you adjust for inflation, was higher then than it is now. And workers near the minimum wage were making more back then than they do now.
When you look at the photos of the workers, say Walmart or the fast food workers who went on strike and rallied over the past few weeks and really the past couple of years, the majority of them are older. I mean, you don't see young people in these photos. Arun, what really strikes you about the low-wage workforce today?
Well, I think in a lot of ways it's just the desperation. I've talked to Walmart workers who are forced to live on as little as $25 a week for groceries. I talked to a couple in Kentucky that's what they have to live on, and they say that, you know, they can't afford any fresh food at all, not even like fresh hamburger meat. Everything is canned food or frozen food, or people having to put off medical care for months at a time. They might have insurance, but they can't take the time off for work, or they're just afraid to take the time off for work because they might lose their jobs. One of the interesting things, especially talking to Walmart workers, was how many actually favor unions. Many of them do, but they live in constant fear that if they agitated for a union, that they would be thrown out on their ear right away. And they know that that's the reality, that you actually have almost no rights in the workplace at all, and that today the workplace is really ruled with fear. And according to various reports, studies of unionization campaign, many thousands of workers, one estimate puts it as high as 50,000 workers a year, are fired for protected union activity in the United States. And so this has really kind of destroyed any chance to mount unionization campaigns at all. And without unions, they're subject to the whims of management and kept in a constant state of fear.
Well, when it comes to Walmart, the National Labor Relations Board is pursuing charges against Walmart for illegally firing and disciplining more than 117 workers. It found that Walmart stores in 14 states across the country unlawfully threatened, disciplined, or terminated employees for engaging in legally protected strikes and protests. So, Arun, because these workers are not unionized, they're really putting their jobs on the line.
Yeah, very much so. And, of course, Walmart is the expert in what is called union avoidance strategy. They've raised it to an art. In cases where workers have been able to successfully unionize, in Canada, for instance, a whole store was unionized, Walmart just shut down the whole store. In another case in the United States, where just a small shop in Texas of something like 8 butchers unionized, Walmart basically got rid of butchers in every single store. So they are very effective and vicious at this. And the problem is the labor law is so weak that even if it does kick into action, it can take a year or more. In the warehouse industry outside of Chicago, there was last year there was a successful organizing campaign going on, and workers actually waged a strike. It was a somewhat spontaneous strike after a lot of intense organizing, and they were able to get back into the workplace. But the company that managed the workers then got rid of all the agitators basically over the next month. And the NLRB, you know, even if they find in favor of the employees, they've had to move on to other jobs. The companies are given very minimal fines, and effectively they were able to bust up the organizing effort. So it really puts a huge amount of power in the hands of the management, and this is something that unions are trying to figure out how to deal with, to come at it in different ways, and hence the Our Walmart campaign and the Fight for 15, the fast food organizing campaign, are two ways that unions are trying to figure out how to organize workers with a broken labor law system. Yeah,
and we'll talk about just the role that unions are playing in all of this. But first off, John, talk about just how big this is, and how did this movement grow so quickly? Because last year on Black Friday, it was the first time that Walmart workers walked out of work or rallied in front of stores. This year, rallies happened in about 1,500 stores, the largest so far. And then we saw the massive fast food worker strike last Thursday. How do you explain the growth in this movement?
Well, I think that the most obvious explanation is that we have had almost four decades now of rising economic inequality. And some of that was masked by a bit of economic growth and relatively low unemployment, say, in the 2000s before the Great Recession. But the Great Recession, I think, has really kicked off a lot of rethinking of the way the economy works and the way it should work. And I trace it back a little bit to the Occupy movement, which really kind of came up out of nowhere in some sense, but obviously tapped into some deep concerns about economic inequality. And it really helped to change the national agenda and the national debate about our economy. It didn't make concrete demands, and now what we have is a kind of next generation where workers are rising up and making very concrete demands in the case of both the Walmart workers and the fast food workers. I think it's just the next logical progression from economic inequality to starting to question it and now starting to make very specific demands.
And what would you say, Arun? What explains this based on the interviews that you've conducted? Why is this movement growing so quickly right now?
I think that's an accurate explanation, that it is the shift from the discussion of austerity to inequality, and just the general sense that the economic system is broken. You have 100 million Americans who live either in poverty or on the cusp of poverty in terms of the whole low-wage workforce. You know, those making under $12 an hour, you're talking something about 38 million Americans. So it's really a huge portion of the population has been impoverished. And then on top of those 38 million Americans, you have about 20-plus million Americans who are either unemployed, have dropped out of the labor force, have never been able to enter the labor force, or been forced to be early retirement or involuntary part-time employed. So this is a large swath of the population. Now, in terms of the specific campaign, this has to do much more about with the union. I think that, you know, like I said, there is a lot of pro-union sentiment out there, but workers aren't just going to spontaneously organize. It takes a huge amount of effort, particularly when you consider the ideological assault that the public has been under for many decades. You know, many workers, even poor workers, still have an anti-union mentality. So that's one of the things that unions are trying to confront, is how to overcome that.
And who's really calling the shots here, Arun? Who's making these decisions?
Well, you know, in the case of our Walmart, UFCW is pretty open about its role. They say it's not a unionization campaign, and again, they have to do that for reasons of labor law, that if they did say it was a unionization campaign, it would have to limit them in terms of the picketing, and Walmart could force an election and basically bust up the campaign very quickly. Now, the other thing to understand about the 1,500 stores, I was at one of the demonstrations in Maryland, as at a lot of these stores, there were no workers involved whatsoever. The one I went to, it was our Walmart had a request, and it was an anonymous request from someone in the store to mount protests. And when we got out there, we started marching onto the Walmart property, and we were met by about a dozen company officials and similar number of police officers who basically told us, you know, that we were trespassing and had to leave the property. The fast food campaign is being mounted by the Service Employees International Union. And in this case, they're very much trying to hide their footprints. They're claiming that this is an alliance of community groups and that it's the workers who are in the lead. In fact, there was a recent article in Salon.com that was basically, it was ludicrous. It stated that the workers were in control locally and nationally. That's not true whatsoever. I talked to over 40 sources, and not one person claimed that the workers had any control whatsoever at the national level. And the only city in which anyone claimed the workers had any sort of real control was in Chicago. And apart from that, SEIU is calling the shots in every way, shape, and form.
Well, and we'll be joined by some workers throughout the show, so we'll definitely ask them how much control they think they have and whether or not the people at the top are listening to them. What are your thoughts on that, John? I mean, how much of a voice do these workers really have when it comes to making these decisions?
Well, I think a crucial issue here is one that Arun talked about, which is how difficult U.S. labor law is for any worker that wants to try and organize. So the unions that are involved in these campaigns are really forced to do innovative, different kinds of strategies to try and get around the labor law. And it's ironic that, you know, labor law, as it was established in the 1930s initially, was an attempt to protect, in part, to protect workers from abusive behavior by employers. And what we have now is a labor law that's been transformed by both acts of Congress and by decisions in the courts in such a way that it makes it extremely difficult for any worker in the private sector to organize. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me that the unions involved here are trying to do things in a way that is not the traditional way that they might organize workers. And I think it has to be seen in that kind of a context. If you look at the public sector, we have public sector unions in the United States where workers are 35 to 40% unionized. And the labor law there is much, much, it's problematic and there's difficulties, but it's much less difficult and employers are much less oppositional to unions than they are in the private sector. And you see in the private sector, we have 6 or 7% of workers in unions. And the difference is fundamentally that it's extremely hard under U.S. labor law to organize workers.
That is John Schmidt. He's senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He recently co-edited Low-Wage Work in the Wealthy World. Arun Gupta is founding editor of the Independent magazine. He wrote a piece about the fast food worker movement in these times. And he's working on a book about the decline of the American empire. And today we are talking about the growing movement, low-wage workers demanding better wages and working conditions. The average fast food worker makes about $8.25 an hour. The McDonald's CEO made $8.7 million last year. That's not his name. I'll find his name in just a minute. But $8.75 million, where the average worker makes about $8.25. And Walmart, the average worker there makes less than $25,000 a year, $8.81. And Walmart CEO Michael Duke brought in $35 million. He gets more in an hour than a full-time employee makes in a year. So what are your thoughts on this movement? How much power do low-wage workers have to change their workplace? And if you work in the service sector, retail, food, or other service jobs, what is your situation like? And what changes have you seen over the past few decades? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Arun, can you talk a little bit more about tactics? What tactics are these workers taking? I mean, in the case of Walmart, for example, I mean, we're seeing Walmart come out with new ads countering the claims made by the workers and our Walmart. And so they've got these shiny ads. And then, you know, there's also Lee Fang with The Nation wrote about Joseph Kefauver, a former Walmart executive who's now running smear campaigns against activists through his government relations firm, Parquet Public Affairs. So talk about the tactics and, like, have we seen any changes for these workers at Walmart since they've been on the streets over the past few years? Arun?
Protests and strikes. They've gone down to various shareholder and investor meetings in Bentonville, Arkansas, where Walmart's headquarters are. They did kind of a civil rights style bus tour. You know, the tactics themselves are, you know, tactics are always tactics. They don't really change that significantly. You know, they've done these walkouts and one-day strikes, but what they're doing is it strikes over unfair labor practices because, again, those are protected under labor law. If you're striking for higher wages or benefits, you can be replaced by scabs. In terms of the judicial rulings that allow striking workers to be fired. But if you are striking over conditions in the workplace, over management abuses, over and retaliation, you are allowed to come back to work, or you're supposed to be allowed. This is why the charges have been brought against Walmart in these 117 or so cases. Now, in terms of the fast food strikes, they've been somewhat more dramatic in terms of these one-day walkouts around the country, you know, that reportedly occurred in 100-plus cities. It started about 1 year ago with just one walkout in New York City with reportedly 200 workers involved. But what many of the workers and organizers who I talk to say, it's what it is it's really a march on the media, that SEIU is engaged in a media and legal strategy. They're not engaging in an organizing strategy. Now, and one thing very important to understand in terms of the mindset of a lot of the workers, you know, is that they're not complaining that SEIU is in charge. No, nobody is saying, like, oh, this is such a terrible thing. What the issue is do workers have any real control, and is this in the workers' interest? And one of the main kind of tensions is SEIU has had some success, and they deserve credit for it in terms of driving initiatives about the minimum wage. So we saw this $15 an hour minimum wage increase in the SeaTac area around the airport, the Seattle-Tacoma Airport. California, of course, recently passed a minimum wage increase. Various other municipalities passed them. I think 2014, we're going to see a lot of ballot initiatives. Mm-hmm. And now there's this push at the federal level to increase the minimum wage by 40% to $10.10 an hour. There's a bill before the Congress supported by the Democrats and Obama as well. And that's great. But one organizer I talked to who's been working with worker centers for a long time, he's like, you know, look, I don't have any problem with this, but, you know, don't tell the workers this is a unionization campaign if it's not a unionization campaign. You know, it's about essentially what many feel is a deception, where workers are being used and they don't know where this is going, and they're perhaps being put at risk, and all these promises are being made to them that are never going to be fulfilled, and the workers have no idea about what's really going to be happening down the road. And of course, nobody can predict what's going to happen, but there's very little evidence that they have any sort of real control whatsoever. Mm. And in fact, a lot of workers have described how the votes are rigged in terms of the strike votes, that, you know, it's presented as, oh, the workers are deciding when to strike. But when we talk to them, it's actually, no, we had no say in it whatsoever. And it's essentially presented as a fait accompli, and all we get to do is rubber stamp decisions made somewhere else.
Well, actually, we're going to go to a worker right after the break, but that is Arun Gupta, founding editor of The Independent magazine. Just quickly, Arun, we've got about 30 seconds before we go to break. Can you talk more about that, about whether workers have any real control here? And how has this changed when you look at the role of unions reaching out to low-wage workers historically?
Well, I think in terms of the control, like I said, it's very minimal. And what's important is the practical effect. In a number of cities where I talk to workers and organizers, there's actually very low activity, such as Seattle and Washington, D.C., because workers, they said that we feel like we're being babied, we're being disrespected, because they're not giving us any real power, and it's obvious to everyone involved. And so this is a problem. But SEIU is also known for not being, to put it mildly, very friendly to rank-and-file democracy, that it's very much top-down unionism. And as one organizer described it to me, or a number did, actually, it's run like a military style campaign.
And everyone, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about the growing movement of low-wage workers demanding better working conditions. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW. If you have a perspective to add to the program that you haven't heard yet in today's discussion, or a question you feel needs to be answered, get in touch with us by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can send your email question or comment to feedback at yourcallradio.com. www.voiceamerica.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Today, live from the memorial for Nelson Mandela in Johannesburg today. President Obama spoke, as did many other luminaries. World Have Your Say from Johannesburg, coming up at 11.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will open the lines to take your book recommendations. We're having our annual year-end book show. If you have any favorite books you would like to recommend, books you read this year, or classics you regularly pick up, we'd love to get your recommendations on tomorrow's show. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation with UC Berkeley geography professor Richard Walker about his new book, The Atlas of California, Mapping the Challenges of a New Era. What do California's changing demographics tell us about the future of the state? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the growing low-wage worker movement. On Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, Walmart workers and their supporters held rallies in almost 1,500 stores. Walmart workers are asking for an end to retaliation for speaking out. Many have been fired for speaking out. They want full-time work, and they want regular schedules and $25,000 a year. The average worker makes $8.71 an hour. And then on Thursday, fast food workers in over 100 cities went on strike to call for their wages to be increased to $15 an hour. Their ultimate goal is to get a collective bargaining agreement. And we're talking about this with Arun Gupta. He wrote a piece about the fast food worker strike for In These Times. He's founding editor of The Independent magazine. John Schmidt is senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He co-edited Low-Wage Work in the Wealthy World. And I'd like to welcome Dominic Ware to the show. Dominic first began working at Walmart in San Leandro as a cart pusher. He had a tough time getting by on $8.25 with the part-time hours Walmart gave him. He said he was troubled by management treatment of the workers, lack of respect for him and his coworkers. He became one of our Walmart's leading spokespeople. He was on television vocally drawing attention to the difficulties, and when he returned home from being on strike, he says Walmart fired him for, quote, absences while he was on strike. Hi, Dominic. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, good. How are you?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. So I understand that you were really troubled by management's treatment of you and your fellow workers. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, pretty much it was just the disrespect on a day-to-day basis. Like Walmart, they have this 15-foot rule, right, where while you're at work, anybody that comes into that vicinity, you must acknowledge them, eye contact, hello, chest up, face up. You know, that's what they wanted me to do on a day-to-day. And it just bothered me that I was going for work, and I would carry that with me. I'm that type of person anyway. And I look to management, even for the slightest hello, good morning, and they'd walk past me and ignore me like they didn't see me, but 5 minutes later they'd demand for something to be done. That's just a little thing that management do on a day-to-day basis that, you know, started bothering me, and I just felt disrespected as a worker.
You know, it's so interesting you say this, Dominic, because when I interview Walmart workers, they say, of course we want better wages, but what we really also want is basic dignity, to be told that you did a good job today, or I acknowledged what you did this week. I hear this over and over again.
Yeah, and it goes farther than that. Just even like the respect for that I'm doing a good job. A lot of people, retail is a career to a lot of people, and just to receive 40 cents after a hard work of dedicating yourself, and it's just disrespect, man. You know, a lot of people take pride in their work at Walmart, and just to see that you get disrespected by management and that you don't even get respected as your job title, doing your job, with better wages and be able to provide for yourself. It's just disrespect on all different levels. So, yeah, like you said, the main thing that we want as a worker is just the respect and dignity that we deserve.
And so you started as a cart pusher. You made $8.25, and you had part-time work. Did you ask for full-time work?
When I first started, it was full-time. Like, I got started around the holiday season, and they needed me. Around February, my hours got cut dramatically, and I tried to bring it up. What they said was just, you got to roll with the punches. You know, this is how it goes. Walmart always slows down, but the customers, it doesn't. The traffic doesn't really change. You know, they tell you that they're not making that much money, but Walmart is still making money all through the year, and they just use that as a tactic to not have that many people on hand to serve people and just cut hours.
And did you know what your schedule was going to be from one week to the next?
You never know. That's really was another problem why I couldn't even try to find another job or even go to school, you know, to better myself, because the schedule fluctuates every month. Mm. Every month you have something different, so it's really hard to plan for anything.
You know, Dominic, what would you say to people who, when they read about workers like you asking for a bigger wage or better working conditions, when they say, go back to school, get a better job, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, mm-hmm. what would you say to them?
I would say, well, what country are you from? The country that I was born in, you know, we fight when things are injustice. We fight when, mm-hmm. you know, our brothers and sisters are not being treated fairly, because actually when I started speaking up, I started getting my hours back. I started, you know, getting the little respect that I deserve as a worker because I demanded it. But what kept me in this fight and what kept me in the mm-hmm. fight is that I sit in that break room and I hear so many heartbreaking stories. There's people that have been working for this company for 10, 20 years, and they're still making below poverty line. That is ridiculous. Walmart makes too much money to not take care of their associates. So people like that, I just say to them, where was your patriotism? Where's your heart lined up at? Do you not see people walking into a Walmart store, see the looks on these people's faces? Like, it shouldn't be that way. And if Walmart didn't make so much money, we wouldn't be demanding that they treat us better. But they do, so this is where we're at.
And Walmart brought in $17 billion in profits last year alone. And their Walmart's CEO, Michael Duke, his salary last year was $35 million. He makes more in an hour than a full-time employee makes in a year. And just quickly, Dominic, before we get to calls, and I hope you can stay with us for a couple calls. You were fired. Why? What explanation did you receive from Walmart?
I went on strike because... like you just said, Mike Duke made how many millions that year? Last year, I made $11,000, my annual salary. That's what I had to put on my tax return. That was a big reason that forced me to stand up and speak out. And this is ridiculous, you know. What did you ask me?
Why you were fired. Walmart said it was for your absences.
Oh. Yes, because we went on the longest strike ever earlier this year, 14 days straight. It was awesome. It was the longest mm-hmm. time anyone has ever went on a strike at Walmart. Me and a group of 100-plus went and did that, came back with promises that no retaliation. We look towards having hours cut or just the same intimidation tactics that we've been dealing with, but they really pushed the line, and they mm-hmm. really crossed the line by firing people illegally, and that's why I was fired, because I stood up with my brothers and sisters, and we demanded that they treat us better, and we went on the longest strike ever, mm-hmm. and I guess they just felt, you know, they felt the pressure. They felt the pressure. We've been around for 3 years now, and they just wanted to strike back, and they did, but thank God that we're still around, and NLRB is ruling in our favor. So I really was just fired because I was avid speaking out for equal rights for everyone at my store, and they really seen me and my brothers and sisters as a threat.
And Dominic, how much power do you feel like you have? Do you feel like the unions and the group like our Walmart, say, for example, people in Washington, D.C. who are involved in this campaign, do you feel like they're listening to workers like you?
Yes. I believe they listen to workers like me, and they listen to sisters and brothers, that the same people that I listen to, they hear these stories, and it's just that it's so real, you know, it's so real, because you can walk past someone on the streets, and you wouldn't think twice, but once you hear their story and their background, it kind of touches you, and that's what we do mm-hmm. with our organization. We get the word out, we get these stories out, we get people like myself who never spoke anything, never had a chance to tell my side of the story, get their story out, and make that connection to everyone in the community and in this country. So, I believe anyone that has mm-hmm. a heart is listening. We have people in Congress listening. We have the attention of everyone, and it's not just mm-hmm. Walmart workers. all low-wage workers. We're grabbing everybody's hearts right now.
And that is Dominic Ware. He worked at Walmart in San Leandro making $8.25 as a cart pusher. He says his hours were cut after the holidays, and he says he was fired because he went on strike for about 2 weeks to call for a higher wages. And Dominic, if you can stay on with us for a couple calls, that would be great.
Of course. It's the highlight of my morning. So sit around.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We're glad to have you on. We're also joined by Arun Gupta, founding editor of The Independent magazine. He writes about these issues for In These Times as well as The Independent. And John Schmidt is senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We're talking about the growing movement of low-wage workers speaking out for better working conditions and higher wages. We've got full lines, but we'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from John in San Francisco, who's an attorney with the NLRB. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I was an attorney with the NLRB. I'm not an attorney now with the NLRB. I'm retired. But the NLRB, as you know, enforces employee rights of organizing and protesting. And one of the significant disadvantages for employees in bringing discrimination claims is that employees can only be awarded back pay if it is found that they have been fired for organizing or protesting working conditions. Unlike employees fired for sex or race discrimination, employees fired for organizing or protesting cannot receive compensatory damages, such as emotional distress or punitive damages. These damages can be very significant, in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it seems that employees engaged in organizing or protesting activities are at a significant disadvantage. This should be changed, but I don't hear unions or anyone arguing for making the change.
Well, and before we let you go, how significant is the recent decision coming out of the NLRB? They're pursuing charges against Walmart for illegally firing and disciplining more than 117 workers in 14 states across the country. Do you think that'll go anywhere?
Sure. The NLRB can be very effective in the short run in helping employees. But the employers make cost-benefit analysis. And you're talking, in the case of Walmart, of course, you're talking about very, very, very wealthy employers. And the amount of damages that the NLRB can award are trivial compared to the wealth of these companies. So they just hire lawyers and string the battle out as long as they can and try to wear the employees down.
Well, could it at least put pressure on Walmart to stop firing employees and to stop? I mean, I interviewed warehouse workers who said they were followed to the bathroom, their hours got drastically cut as soon as they spoke out. Could this at least end for these workers?
The NLRB can get a cease and desist order, but it takes a long time to get that. And in the meantime, employees are going to be intimidated by Walmart and their activities, and they're going to be discouraged from continuing those activities because they need a job. If somebody is fired for union activities and they can only receive back pay, what's the incentive for them carrying on the fight? And what is the incentive for employees picking up the flag for their fired employees because they know they may be next?
And you don't think unions are doing enough to put pressure on the NLRB to take real action here?
I don't think my call specifically concerns the issue of allowing employees who are fired or discriminated against for organizing and protesting activities to also be eligible for compensatory and punitive damages. Only if you get into Walmart's and the other big companies' pockets, and we're talking about big money that can be awarded through juries, as they have been in race and sex discrimination cases, will you find out that the employers are willing to compromise?
Well, thank you so much for calling in, John. John is a former attorney with the NLRB. And Arun, just quickly, did you talk to unions about this issue? And why aren't they doing more on this front?
Well, the unions were not very cooperative, to put it mildly, in terms of talking to me at all, especially SEIU. But I think the answer to that is that, unfortunately, they've become far too close to the Democratic Party. And often what the union leaders are doing is much more in the interest of getting Democratic Party officials elected and reelected than really agitating for the interests of their workers, because the Democrats have become, in many instances, very hostile to workers. Mm-hmm. Of course, the Obama administration has attacked the teachers' unions. They were very hostile to the auto workers' unions in the bailout. Unions in 2008, organized labor, put a huge amount of energy and resources into getting Obama elected, and they had great hopes that he would put his weight behind the Employee Free Choice Act, which would allow what's called card check unionization. This is another way to basically get around the broken labor law, whereas if you get 50% of workers in a workplace to sign union cards, then you automatically win. You don't have to go through the whole election process where management can intimidate and threaten workers for months and basically legally frighten them into not voting for the union. And Obama didn't put any significant political weight behind the bill that came up, and it failed. And it just kind of goes on and on and on. Of course, the whole Wisconsin uprising during the 2008 campaign, Obama made a big deal about he would be on the picket lines if there was any such attack, and then he was AWOL when this fight happened in Wisconsin in 2011. So you really have unions that are just, I think, far too tied to the hip to the Democratic Party and are unwilling to challenge the anti-worker ideology at the core of what is just really another party of Wall Street.
What union is tied to our Walmart?
United Food and Commercial Workers. And I think one of the interesting things now, you know, it's just like these campaigns are important, but there are also very specific strategies going on. With the Our Walmart campaign, in many ways, this is what is a rear guard action. You see, what UFCW, it has a very large worker base. It has something like about 1.5 million members. What they're trying to do is protect their workforce, who tend to be concentrated in urban areas, and they want to keep Walmart out of cities, and they have been somewhat successful. They've been trying to organize Walmart since the 1990s with very little luck, but it has allowed them to keep Walmart out of municipalities, which is protecting their unionized workforce. So I think they're genuine in wanting to organize Walmart workers, but they're up against enormous odds.
And Dominic, again, you worked for Walmart in San Leandro. $8.25 you made as a cart pusher. You said you were fired after going on strike for 2 weeks. Did you have any conversations with all our Walmart about the possibility of being fired and losing your job?
Yeah, we all knew that since the first strike I went on. You know, that's the wonderful thing about I love our Walmart, because the first thing is educate workers on their rights, their exact rights. And, you know, also to Walmart's rule books, like, you know, we pick and choose when we do certain things, and it was just the time. We went on one-day strike, two-day strikes, and Walmart kept intimidating us, cutting hours, so we had to take it up. We had to do something more dramatic. I was ready to go on strike for months. I was ready to go, but I was advised. We talked amongst each other that we were not going to do it that way, and I knew of the risks, but the reward was worth way more, and that's what I was focused on when I went on strike.
And what are you doing now?
Still organizing, still going to actions. It's a lot of work to be done. Mm. Out here in the Bay Area is a beautiful place, known for rising up, people getting educated, coming together. So that's just my livelihood now. You know, I jumped into this organization, and it grew me into an activist, full-blooded activist. That's what I do. I'm still trying to educate workers, because it's really up to workers everywhere for us to come together, and I'm surviving, so I'm all right.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that. We've got just a few more minutes to take a few more calls. Let's hear from Jack in Los Altos. Hi, Jack. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'd like a response from your guests regarding a report published by the Institute for Policy Studies entitled Fast Food CEOs Rake in Taxpayer-Subsidized Pay. And yeah, this report apparently exposes CEOs have saved billions of dollars paying their workers near starvation wages while buttressing their own pay with government-subsidized dollars. Incredibly, a perverse loophole in the tax code allows companies to deduct the cost of performance-based executive pay.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up because this gets to another sort of the crux of the issue, and that is, can these corporations, quote, afford to pay these workers more? And according to this report, during the past 2 years, the CEOs of the top six publicly held fast food chains pocketed more than $183 million in deductible performance pay, lowering their company's IRS bills by $64 million. At the top of the list is Yum Brands. They got the biggest taxpayer subsidy. The firm owns Taco Bell, KFC, and Pizza Hut. Their CEO, David Novak, brought in $94 million in fully deductible, quote, performance pay. That's a $33 million taxpayer subsidy. And then McDonald's received the second largest government handout. James Skinner brought in $31 million in exercise stock options and fully deductible, quote, performance pay. Can you talk a little bit about this, John?
Sure. Can I just add one more comment?
Just quickly, go ahead.
Yeah, I think what going on here is we're seeing an attempt to reverse a huge increase in economic inequality that started at the end of the 1970s. You have to remember that from the 1930s to the 1970s, the U.S. economic inequality was actually falling that entire period. And now we've seen this reversal led by corporate policymaking, basically, that has allowed almost all of the benefits of economic growth for the last 40 years to go to the very, very top, and essentially all of the growth since the economic recovery started a few years back has gone to the top 1%. So there is plenty of money. We are an extremely rich country. The problem that we have right now is not a problem of national poverty. The problem we have is a problem of national inequality and the distribution. So the corporations that are the subject of these organizing campaigns and actions are well-situated, well-positioned to be able to pay workers a substantially higher wage. We know that because they used to pay low-wage workers a substantially higher wage, and they did just fine.
So what are the facts here? Because in the media reports, you'll get two competing economists saying things like, for example, the New York Times had a piece about the $15 wage for fast food workers. And Aaron Drott-Dube, an economist, economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, said an increase in pay to $15 would push up fast food prices by about 20%. And then you've got Ken Jacobs at UC Berkeley saying, well, that's not the case, maybe 10%. So what do the facts tell us? And is it the case that if McDonald's paid their workers $15, your Big Mac is going to go up?
I think it's certainly possible that if we pay workers at the bottom more, that some prices would go up somewhat. There is a lot of evidence that's looked at the impact of the minimum wage on fast food prices and on retail prices and on the general price level. And the effects are generally pretty small. So I would say it's probably on the low end of the numbers that you just talked about. But the key issue here is that there are a lot of ways that firms can respond to wage increases. And one of the ones that those same two economists you cited emphasize a lot is a big decrease in turnover. And turnover is very expensive for employers, even for low-wage workers. It's expensive to have that. So if you can reduce turnover, you can actually save companies money, save firms money, and offset a lot of the increase in costs without having to increase prices or even cut into profits. Now, what I personally would like to see is a decrease in profits that's shifted towards workers at the middle and the bottom, and that's also a possibility as well.
And then you've got Walmart. Again, they brought in $17 billion in profits last year. I should say it brought in. And Demos came out with a new report that found Walmart spent $7.6 billion buying back shares last year. If they would have used that money to provide their low-wage employees with a raise, they could have given them about $5.83 an hour. Does this kind of report make sense to you, John? I mean, is this even realistic?
Yeah, no, I think it goes to exactly the issue that the way corporations are currently run, they are run for a relatively narrow group of shareholders, and these kinds of buyback plans help to boost the price of stock, which makes people who own stock richer. and it comes at the expense of the people that work in the stores and makes them poorer. So it's a straight-up distributional discussion. They could have done a lot of things with that money, and what they decided to do was that. Now, they'll tell you we have a responsibility to our shareholders, and I would say we need to step beyond that. We need to structure our corporate law. We need to rearrange our social policy. So the corporations also have a responsibility to their customers and to their workers.
And we're going to be doing a show about CEO pay next week, so be sure to tune in for that. And final thoughts, Arun, about 30 seconds. Where do you see this movement going?
Well, certainly it's had a big impact on the minimum wage. Whether it ends in unionization, though, I think is highly questionable. There is no clear path to unionization. But I do want to say one thing very quickly about turnover. I take a differing approach because there is such high turnover. I've talked to people who worked in shops where there were 30 workers and they were all gone within 6 months, that this is actually a way that the businesses keep down the wages by having this huge turnover every 6 months to a year. So we have to understand this is what they want. It's not a cost of doing business to them.
All right. And Dominic, final thoughts from you just briefly. Where do you see this movement going?
I see the increase in minimum wage. Living wage has been rising too much. Governments have been giving themselves too many raises and not enough raises to the people. I just see that this movement raising awareness, and hopefully it'll raise people's awareness to where it stays at a place where we stay active. And as a community, as a nation, we do not sit around and let this happen again.
Dominic Ware worked for Walmart in San Leandro, making $8.25 as a cart pusher. He had part-time hours, wanted full-time work. He says he was fired because he went on strike for 14 days to call for better wages and the opportunity to work full-time. Arun Gupta is founding editor of the Independent magazine. He's writing about these issues for In These Times. John Schmidt is a senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What were your favorite books this year? On the next Your Call, we're having our year-end book show. Do you have friends or family you'd love to give a book to if only you had a recommendation? What classics do you regularly pick up? Call in or email us with your favorites. We'll also get recommendations from independent bookstore owners. Join the conversation and call in with your book recommendations on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan, Ali Budner, and Becca Hoekstra produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.